Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Justine, while I was waiting for you to finish what you were doing, which I think was your job, I was surfing YouTube, and it's more fun and can easily get lost than you can imagine.
I guess.
And one thing I learned from YouTube today, I would love to have dinner with Ryan Reynolds and Paul Rudd.
Okay.
Not only are they delicious to look at, I think it would be nonstop funny.
Yes, yes, yes. You might feel pressure to keep up, however.
I don't know if I could keep up with them both. They'll just keep laughing. Yeah. Before we begin, I want to welcome some friends of ours to the podcasting world. Welcome Corey and DeMonica with the new Queer Culture Podcast. And culture is with a Q. And now on their show, they'll be exploring queer historical figures, movies, legends, revolutions throughout time and all over the world. They'll be examining their significance at the time and relevance and meaning now.
That sounds wonderful.
It does sound wonderful. In addition, every Friday, they'll discuss topics such as the story of the cut sleeve in China, the first transgender surgeon in the British Army, and the after effects of colonialism queerness in different countries. Now, that's all some heavy stuff.
It is. That is.
But it's not all heavy stuff they're going to talk about, because it is queer culture. Have you ever seen Imagine Me and You?
No.
Okay. It's one of my favorite gay movies. It's a rom-com with some drama, and it has two lesbians who meet and fall in love.
Okay.
And now for one of the characters, it happens to be really bad timing for her to fall in love with someone else.
Huh. How unusual.
It happens to be her wedding date.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's a little more unusual than most people who have fallen in love at the wrong time.
Comedy ensues.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a disaster movie to me, but okay.
It's actually a lot of fun. I highly recommend the film. And another one they're going to talk about, have you ever heard of Big Eden?
What are you going to do? Like, you could criticize me for my lack of film knowledge? I don't know any straight rom-coms either, you know.
Okay. So it's the lack of film knowledge, just not lack of queer film knowledge.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Big Eden is probably my husband Maurice's favorite movie, at least LGBTQ movie.
Okay.
It's also a romantic comedy drama love story. And it's a New York man who has to return to his hometown of Big Eden, Montana, to care for his ailing father. And what makes this movie great is Big Eden is a fitting name, because there is no coming out angst, no disapproval from the local townspeople. There's no homophobic content or dialogue. It's just a love story with the locals.
That sounds wonderful. Do you have any idea what streaming services they're on?
You know, they change that every week nowadays. One week it's on Netflix, the next week it's on Amazon. I don't know.
I have this, like, mad desire to have an app where you can just plug in the name and it hooks you to the right streaming service.
Oh, nice. You'll have to send me that.
It's just in my head.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know how you keep it in your head. One day it'll be one thing and the next day it's
No, what I'm saying is the app is in my head. Boy, we are just not communicating today.
No, I'm going to hang up now. Goodbye.
I meant I want somebody to invent an app that does that.
Oh, I see. That would be a perfect app.
Yes, yes. And every now and then I like mention this to random people and it never happens.
I'm sure you have Netflix.
I have all of them.
Okay, I think they've all moved to Disney now, but they used to list Disney films. Sometimes the Avengers would be under A for Avengers, and the very next day you would find it under T for The Avengers.
Huh.
And it would change back and forth all the time.
I just used the voice command on my remote.
Well, la-dee-da. So again, it's Corey and DeMonica, and it's Queer Culture, and culture is with a Q. So,
okay.
Welcome to the podcasting world. We're happy to have you.
It sounds wonderful. It really does. It really does.
I did want to give a list of who's coming up.
Okay.
Okay, these are guests that are coming up, and you can leave a message for them if you'd like me to ask them a question. We have Bill Prystok, Marco Coricari.
Oh, you learned his name.
If I'm reading his pronunciation that he wrote out for me in the email, yes.
All right.
So it's Marco Coricari. If I'm wrong, he will correct me when he's on the show. But I think I got it.
Okay.
And then we have Michael Nava and then Joseph DeMarco.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, have a good list coming up. And I do want to thank Philip Barr, one of our listeners, who has already sent in a question to ask one of our guests.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah.
Yes. So that'll be fun. That's going to be great. A first.
Yeah.
A first of many, we hope.
And I've been getting a couple of feedback through email and through my Facebook Messenger, and everybody should feel free to reach out.
Absolutely. Good deal.
Okay.
And I think you're up. I think that's all I have.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I have an absolutely wonderful book this week. This is one of my favorite mysteries that I've read. So I was looking for a book to review that wasn't paranormal and wasn't a gay male PI in Los Angeles who, you know, doesn't deal with his feelings. So it took me a while to kind of sort through my back catalog and, you know, find something that didn't fit either of those categories. And I realized, I probably have way too much of those two. So what I have found is Bury Me When I'm Dead, which is the first of the Charlie Mack Motown series by Cheryl Head. And Charlie Mack is a bisexual black woman who has a private investigating agency in Detroit, which is why it's a Motown mystery. But it's also not LA. And it's interesting that each city has its own flavor. And it really is a lot different if you have an LA PI, and all the LA PIs, you know, have that same kind of feel. And, you know, the Detroit PI is much different.
And this is the first book in the series you're talking about?
This is the first book in her series.
Okay. I love Cheryl Head. She has a new book coming out soon. I can't recall if it's part of the series, but keep an eye out. And it is coming up.
Okay. So it starts out with the reason for the title is Charlie Mack is buried alive. And then the rest of the book, or at least the book, drops back at that point to the beginning of the tale, which has led up to being buried alive like this. So Charlie, she has been a small business owner, and then she went into Homeland Security. And now she has a PI agency, which she has two partners who are both Gil and Don. They were both with her at the Homeland Security. And unlike a lot of PIs, she isn't just starting out and she isn't, you know, hurting for money. They've got a full-fledged agency, three partners and an administrative assistant. And they have a lawyer who handles some of their stuff, but he's off screen, or she's off screen. I'm not sure that the gender is identified. Charlie has been married before to a man. She had a 6-month fling with one of her partners, and now she's in a relationship with a woman, and has been in this relationship for a year, and the woman is a police officer. So that should cast the characters. You also have Charlie's mother, who is a very elegant woman who is suffering from the beginning stages of Alzheimer's. And this is just a fabulous book. They get called in to investigate a employee who's been embezzling and who has taken off down to Birmingham. So they travel to Birmingham, and the entire mystery is larger, more intricate, and far more dangerous than they had ever expected. There are dead bodies, then there are people coming after them. There was a shootout in a parking lot, Charlie getting buried alive, and then, you know, the final exciting scene, they've got some FBI involved, they've got some local police in Birmingham, they got some local police in Detroit. It's just, you know, it's every scene is a delight, and they just keep coming at one after the other, and it just, you just keep rollicking through this tale. It is terrific. It is really terrific.
It sounds like a lot of fun stuff going on. No dull moments.
No dull moments. The employee who's embezzled is also black, and it has returned to a black neighborhood in Birmingham where everybody seems to be connected to everybody else. And some of the best clues she picks up while going to a black barbershop where everybody is gossiping around. And it's just, it's all a delight. The characters they meet once are a delight. The supporting cast is a delight. And Charlie herself is quite an interesting character. It's a great introduction to the series, and there are a lot more books to read after that.
I'm taking that this is the book that you messaged me one day and said, I'm really into it.
Yes, I was really relishing it. You know, I tend to read quickly, but I kind of slowed myself down. I stopped and took breaks to kind of think about the scene that was going on. I really had a lot of fun with this one. It's one of the best books I have read over the last year or two. I can't say enough good things.
Did you give it a ranking?
Well, it kind of straddles two categories, the intriguing recommendation and a thrilling recommendation. And I just could not choose between them.
You had to go with both.
Had to go with both.
Well, it's an intriguing, thrilling novel.
Yep. And we're happy to say that Requeered Tales has procured a foreword from Ms. Head for the third book in the Virginia Kelly series by Nikki Baker, which is coming out in the next couple of months. And Nikki Baker has been a huge inspiration to Cheryl Head, and she was very pleased to be able to write that forward. Well, willing to write that forward. We were thrilled to have her.
That's great.
Okay.
Well, I'll see you next week.
Sounds great. Thank you, Brad.
Oh, hey, I forgot to say one thing.
Okay.
I almost got out scot-free. I know. This is really quick. I've been saying every week that people can donate to buy me a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And they just click on the link and they can donate. And I've been saying, I think you can do a monthly pledge. I finally got smart and looked.
And I was wondering when you'd get to that.
You know, it takes me a while, even though, whatever. I did look, and people can set it up for, I want to give so many dollars every month on a rolling basis to the show. So it is very nice. That's an option. But as I've emphasized before, if you just want to leave a tip, it allows you to just leave a tip.
Sounds good.
So there's a clarification. I think I have some others, but that's the one off the top of my head.
Okay. Are there any other clarifications sitting in your notes?
No. Actually, I don't have a huge pile of scrap paper, so no, I don't have notes.
Okay, sounds good. We'll see you next week, Brad.
Okay, see you then, Justine. We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. My guest, Wendy Hurd, is the author of two adult thrillers, The Kill Club and Hunting Annabelle, which Kirkus Reviews praised as a diabolically plotted creep show from writer to watch. She's Too Pretty to Burn, which Kirkus called a wild and satisfying romp in a starred review, marks her young adult debut. She is a member of Sisters in Crime International Thriller Writers and Mystery Writers of America, is a contributor at CrimeReads.com, and co-hosts the Unlikable Female Characters podcast. Wendy lives one of my neighbors here in Los Angeles, California. Hi, Wendy.
Well, hello, Brad. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm glad to have you on. I'm glad to have a neighbor. I talk to people all over the world, and it's good to have somebody, I guess LA, we'll say it's my neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, it is really, really cool. I don't know just what you mean. Sometimes it feels like there's no novelists in Los Angeles, and then when you meet one, it's so exciting.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. Last week, I had somebody from Scotland.
Oh, cool.
And I was able to actually understand them. He was great. I'm terrible with accents.
Oh, that's awesome.
I want to start by discussing your podcast, Unlikable Sure. Female Characters. Kristen LaPionka was on not long mm-hmm. ago, and I'd like you to refresh our memory as to what the podcast is, what it's about.
The podcast is, it's about exploring female characters who don't give a damn if you like them is our little slogan. But it is based on this idea that authors get asked about all the time, especially cis women, about, you know, are your characters likable? Is this female character likable? Is she unlikable? I mean, the word likable and unlikable, those two words come up in like a third of my reviews for my books. Like they're all over the place for all, you know, especially in crime fiction, we have, you know, questionable moral character in a lot of our people in our books. And so we just got asked about that so much. And it kind of was a tipping point where at BoucherCon, in almost every single panel with women on the panel, audience members were asking about the place of unlikability. You know, where does unlikability belong? Like, do they have to be likable? Can they be unlikable? And Kristen Lane and I just wanted to sort of explore the idea of like, what is that even? What is it to be likable or unlikable? It's interesting because, for example, if I don't like mushrooms, right? I'll say, I don't really like mushrooms. I think they're slimy. I hate them. I actually like mushrooms. But I don't say mushrooms are unlikable because I know that some people do like mushrooms. So it's an interesting thing we do to women where we say they're likable or unlikable, and as though there's some sort of universal or subjective measure of likability, which is interesting because when we say like, it's really referring to personal preference. So the idea that a person could be likable or unlikable is so multi-layered, and we've spent a couple years talking about it. The three of us were emailing about something. We were upset about something. It was because there was an awards category, and the award there was like, it was for like an LGBTQ awards categorization. And there was like gay literature, lesbian literature, and that was it. And there was nothing in there for bisexual literature, or it wasn't even that there was a place where you could say, it wasn't like gay, lesbian, and everything else. You know, it wasn't like there was a category for everything else. Like maybe there would be a category that was like ace and bi, and maybe you wanted to categorize the other ones or something because you didn't want a separate awards for everything, but there was literally nowhere. So we always had to choose, like, are we going to go into the lesbian category? But our character is bisexual. At the time, that, you know, was just something that was irritating us. And so we were kind of chatting about it. And then it led to a conversation about this and how we'd always really wanted to explore it. And we ended up starting the podcast.
Well, I think there's still a lot of people that don't believe in bisexuality, that you need to choose one or the other. Which one is it?
Oh, I know. I feel I've met them all. I think I was sitting in the back seat of a friend's car and we're going to dinner. And I'm like in this car with people who have known me for like 15 years or something. And she turns around and says, well, I don't believe in bisexuality. And I'm like, I am living proof. Like, I don't know what else I can do except like promise you that I'm sitting here and I'm real. You want to pinch me?
I got to admit, I went through it for a little bit of time. I was actually married to a woman at one point. Mm-hmm. And when I came out of the closet, I was seeing a therapist at the Gay and Lesbian Center in Las Vegas. And he said to me, I think you're one of the only real bisexuals I've ever met. And
okay.
I thought, well, first of all, I thought that was odd because he was there at the center. And I will say, in the end, I'm not bisexual. I'm a gay man. You know, was married to a woman. But I went through that whole process of is there really such a thing? And I don't know. There's a survey that just came out recently. I don't know if you saw it. And I hesitate to bring it up because I can't remember the source. But it was a good source. And it was surveyed, you know, are you gay, lesbian, bisexual, straight, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing that came out of the survey was the huge jump in bisexuality. Mm-hmm. 11% of the people said they were bisexual.
Oh, I saw that survey too.
Yeah.
I did too. And I don't remember the source either.
Yeah. They said was a huge jump. And they think it's because people are more comfortable now saying I'm bisexual.
There was another really interesting piece of research I found. And I have it written down, but again, I can't remember the source that was talking about coming out and the relief and the sense of psychological healing for people after coming out. So it was a specific survey on coming out. And I was doing this research during a book I was writing, The Kill Club, actually. But there was no detected sense of relief or of feeling of coming home to anything or anything like that for bisexuals. It was actually an added stressor. The coming out experience, it didn't offer anything on the other side of it that was any sort of a feeling of relief or of a release of tension. it's something that I think, you know, I want to say, like, especially for men, but maybe not, but because I spent the 90s feeling like I had to be quiet about it or people would think I was slutty, you know, so, but I mean, it's like one of those things where, you know, I think I've seen so many men where it's like, if you're bi, you're gay. And for a woman, it's like, if you're bi, you're straight, you know, you're, and I think it's interesting because most bi women I know are married to men, or I'd say like more than half of the bi women I know are married to men. And then more than half of the bi men I know are married to men. And it's interesting how we get sorted or how we feel. I don't know why that happens, but it is a weird thing, a weird feeling. And I'm happy that more people are feeling comfortable to say that out loud.
Well, I know my past experience, both in Vegas and LA, having been at the Gay and Lesbian Center quite a bit at both, there were gay men's groups and I believe lesbian groups, but I don't recall any bisexual groups. I hope that's changed, but I don't think there were.
I don't remember anything like that. When I first started dating, you know, more widely after high school, if I was in a relationship with a girl or a woman, it was like I kind of would join the lesbian subculture, you know, and kind of like just end up at the lesbian things. And then if I was dating a guy, I would end up at the straight things. You know, there wasn't really anywhere I felt to be bisexual and just live in that like authentic space. It always felt like you're having to kind of shut off part of it, you know, or shut off or sort of go in camouflage or something. And I think it's worth mentioning that our experiences are also like I'm 41, you know, I think that people in their 20s are experiencing this very differently, you know, and like what I said about like my bi female friends are mostly married to men. I don't think that's necessarily true of everybody. That could be just my experience. So I do want to say that like my experiences are limited to, you know, I was in my 20s in the aughts, you know, and so it was just a different time too. You know, things have changed.
Yeah. So as far as your books go, you have three books that I know of that have been published. The first is Hunting Annabelle, which came out in 2018, and that's a thriller. And The Kill Club, your second book, is also a thriller. Your third book, the most recent one, which is on pre-order now, correct? Or is it out?
It comes out the March 30th.
Okay, so it is on pre-order. She's Too Pretty to Burn. Now, that is a thriller, but it's a young adult thriller.
Yeah, that's my first young adult book that I've published.
Yeah, what made the change?
It was just an exciting opportunity and idea. It was kind of an interesting one. The editor for this, my agent kind of knew that she would be interested in an idea like this. So I sold this one on proposal. So it was one of those things where I have this list of book ideas and, you know, my agent is, and I are always going through different book ideas. And so it was pretty collaborative, the idea to write a young adult book. You know, she was like, what do you think about writing a young adult book? And I was like, well, yeah, I have, you know, a whole file full of ideas. I had written young adult before adult. And then I had shelved those projects. They didn't get published. And then I went into adult. But my adult projects skew young anyway. Like Hunting Annabelle, the main character, what he's like 20, 22. And he's young. I can't remember. Oh my God, that's so funny. I wrote that book like 5 years ago. He's 22, 23. And in Kill Club, she's 28. So, and they read young, I think. I've heard that from people that my books read young. So it was a pretty natural transition. And this is an editor that I knew I really wanted to work with, and I've been really enjoying working with her. So, yeah. So I hope to write more young adult books.
I actually know quite a few adults that enjoy reading young adult novels.
They're very character focused. You know, I had to learn how to bring the emotions forward in every scene and deal with, I don't know. It was really interesting to write about teenagers. I love teenagers, and it's such an interesting time of the life to explore. And a good time of the life to write thrillers about, because there's so many stakes and you're kind of trapped in these boxes, you know, by parental and just societal. And you're sort of, it's not like with adults where it's like, okay, I'll just use my credit card to buy this thing and get out of town. You know, you don't have as many options. So it's a good age group to write thrillers about.
It's a good age group to write thrillers about. How was it growing up as a teenager?
I'm from LA. I grew up in, I went to high school in Van Nuys, and it was the, you know, mid to late 90s. So LA was quite an interesting place at that time. I don't know if you were living in LA at that time.
I was a teenager in North Carolina at the time.
Yeah, LA was pretty wild. There was a lot going on, you know. And so it was an interesting time to grow up, especially I was like low-income LA. Definitely, I would say that it's an interesting way to grow up and then to write about suburban teenagers. In this case, one of the characters is like low-income, more how I grew up. She and her mom living in apartment number 11 of all their apartments that they've ever lived in. My mom and I think by the time I turned 18, I had lived in 18 different apartments. Wow. And so, yeah. And my dad is in San Francisco, and he also, like, I would spend summers and breaks there. So every year there'd be like a new apartment for each of them. It was pretty funny. So, yeah. So that like is how I wrote one of the main characters. And the other one is sort of suburban and like a little bit more upper middle class. And that was interesting to put them together and the difference in the things they struggle with. And I don't know, I'd really wanted to write about that. What it feels like to be, I remember being a teenager and going to an occasional party at like the private school down the street. And I'd walk into these kids' houses and just be like, this is such a trip. Like, this is so weird, you know? Yeah.
I think I had a problem relating to teenagers when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I went through that whole thing of, you know, everybody hates me. And I was voted the senior class president, but I still thought nobody liked me, you know, that whole stage. Mm-hmm. Especially being a closeted gay teenager, which you can imagine in North Carolina in my time, the Klan was pretty active in my high school. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. It's still that way in some areas in the South. So my husband, who's a black man, says he's never going to go with me if I ever go back home to visit.
You're like, I don't blame you.
So you write LA settings. You grew up here. I didn't grow up here, but I've been in LA 20 years, I guess. And I have a real connection with it. And my novels take place in LA. And I think most people in the city do write LA settings. Mm-hmm. Why do Angelenos like to write about the city so much? Do you have any idea?
I've actually only done it once. My second book is the only one set in LA. And I really wanted it to be special. I personally had been wanting to write about LA forever. And I wanted to write about the LA that you don't see on TV, like the real LA, the working class LA, the LA that's not glamorous. You know, what is it like to live in an apartment and like have a normal job in a restaurant or a grocery store? Like, you know, what, like most of our city is in that demographic and not in the demographics that you see on TV. It's like growing up here, there's this feeling of you're walking through the city and you come across a barrier and you realize they're filming and they've blocked off the street and you can't walk there. And so there's all the people on this side of the barrier and you're like, damn it, where am I going to walk? And then you look on the other side and they've brought in all the beautiful LA extras and they're all coiffed and gorgeous and, you know, sparkling clean and their makeup's on perfect and they're 23 years old and everybody's beautiful. And then you look on the other side and it's like the normal LA people, the people who actually live here, that they have to get out of the shot so that they can shoot LA as it appears in TV and movies. And so I think that people who live here are always striving to sort of pull back that layer, like peel that back a little bit and examine what's underneath it and either show something more authentic or like, I guess, have their say. It often feels like our city is constantly being depicted through the eyes of people who are not from here. People move here from other places and then they write movies and they shoot movies about our city. But like they're, you know, it's like it's always through the eyes of people who come here and they stay, they spend all their time in like five parts of the city. You don't see them venturing out into like Van Nuys, you know. It's like, mm-hmm. I was actually listening to My Favorite Murder and they were joking about Van Nuys and how it's like the place for car dealerships. And I was like, okay, that's fair. But also that's what I mean. Like people from outside of LA, like that's the type of things they're like, oh, that's the gross part of town. I don't go to the Valley. I don't date people in the 818 or, you know, I don't go east of Koreatown or like, you know, it's like, there's most of the geographical area of the city that never shows up on screen. And I think we always kind of want to set the record straight.
Well, I've lived in the Valley. I lived in Studio City, which was very nice, and some other areas.
Yeah, it's nice.
I did live in Van Nuys for a short time, and no, it wasn't my favorite part of town to live in. So I could relate to that completely.
Okay, but the donuts are on point. The donut stores in Van Nuys are great. You can get some serious donuts in Van Nuys.
Well, next time I'm in Van Nuys. I'm on the complete opposite side of the city now. I'm in the South Bay area.
Cool.
Next time I'm in Van Nuys, I'll have to pop in and get some donuts. Wrote that down. Yeah.
The little mom and pop mini mall donuts. That's what I'm talking about. I hope that somewhere out there, there's an Angelino like screaming, yes, along with me.
Well, and part of the reason I brought up why our Angelinos really enjoy reading books that take place in LA. Sometimes I wonder if to middle of America, if they get a little tired of reading books and watching TV shows that all take place in Los Angeles or New York.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing a lot more PI novels taking place in other cities. I know Cheryl Head's character is in Detroit.
Oh, yeah, those are great.
Yeah, and Donald Stacey, I think, is in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, there's Vanessa Lilly, who's writing mystery thrillers out in Providence, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen LaPianca does really atmospheric ones in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah, I know what you mean. I love to see these really atmospheric settings in cities that we don't see all the time.
Well, going back to what you were saying about people's perception of LA, Hollywood has done a really great job of selling Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I tell people when you come out here, you'll find most of us are as frumpy as the rest of the country. And you look around and most people look like they came from the Midwest because we aren't all gorgeous and beautiful and don't fit the type that you see on television all the time. But also another thing that you said that I thought was funny was regarding the barriers for where they're recording shows. I used to live three doors down from, do you remember the TV show Seventh Heaven?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's about a minister and his family.
Yeah.
I used to live three doors down from the church that they used for the outside settings.
Oh, cool.
And every time they would be recording, I would be so pissed off because I had to go round about way to get. And I think about that. People from, well, I know my sister when she was in town and she saw they had the Batmobile on display. She was like in awe. She couldn't, you know, she was so excited. And when you live here, you're just like, it's just annoying, you know?
So, I went to high school and the high school I went to, they used for a lot of different things. It was like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High School. And then I was going to high school, they filmed Clueless there and they were always filming the Power Rangers there. and so they were constantly shutting down the quad and the front so that you had to go in and out through these like side. And, you know, Van Nuys is, you know, if you've been, as you've lived in Van Nuys, as you well know, it's not the most affluent area. I mean, there's definitely some little pockets that are affluent and definitely there were some kids I went to high school with who were like from Sherman Oaks and like lived in nice houses. But for the most part, Van Nuys, it's a pretty, it's a like lower income part of the city for anyone who's not from here, you know? And so it was really weird to be like, you're going on the bus to go home. I mean, I used to take the bus all the way down Coldwater Canyon to get home and like, you're like a frumpy LA kid with like your pants dragging on the ground and like, you know what I mean? Like you're not a glamorous kid at all. And so you'd be like barriered off and the courtyard would be full of all the clueless kids, you know, like with their like, looks like they just got sprayed with Coloss. I mean, they're just like so perfect.
Yeah.
And I have all these memories of like falling asleep in Spanish class and waking up and the Power Rangers guys like sneaking outside the window. And like, what is happening? This is ridiculous.
Back to your book, She's Too Pretty to Burn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a chance now to do your sales spiel. What is that book about?
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm terrible at this. It's funny when people ask you this and you're like, it's about some people and they just like have problems. so it's a Dorian Gray reimagining. So I'm an artist. I have a degree in visual arts. And so this book is about, in Dorian Gray, there's a portrait that's painted of him that it allows him to achieve immortality. It's a speculative novel. In this book, it's not speculative. It's instead of a portrait having actual magic, it's talking about the magic of social media. And so it's a portrait of a girl that goes viral on social media. And on the one hand, it's a thriller. There's a thriller plot and they get involved in this underground art scene. And there's like, you know, bad things and murder and things like that. But on the other hand, the heart of the book is really about what it means to be the object, the subject, the muse. And I've always found it really interesting. Dorian Gray is not a very three-dimensional character. And I wanted to gender swap that and talk about that from a female perspective of what it feels like to be a girl, to turn a certain age where you're suddenly excruciatingly the object of that kind of attention, and what that experience is like, especially for a queer girl who's not altogether comfortable with herself and isn't ready for that kind of attention. And so I kind of wanted to explore the sort of dehumanization of that. And in that conversation, talk about, you know, there's this ickiness of like, but you're so lucky if you're attractive and everybody wants to look at you. If you have these great abs, you should show them. It's a waste if you don't show them. Your body is a waste. Like, you're a waste if you don't show the world your beauty. Like, your purpose is decorative. And it's the start of the darkness behind all of that from the perspective of the person receiving that, going from girl to woman and realizing that all eyes are on you in this very creepy way that, I don't know, I wanted to really unpack that. And I thought a thriller was a good way to do that because it's a way to create that psychological darkness and draw someone in that very vulnerable state into a series of dark events.
How different was it writing a young adult novel compared to your other novels?
Well, I took it very seriously. Like, I'm talking to teenage girls, you know, and I'm doing it for the first time. And I want to make sure I'm saying things that are, first of all, that make them feel seen, right? Like, I want to say things that speak to the moment that they're in, but I also wanted to take care and to not, I was really careful with things like triggers. And it was really important to me. This book is not, there's not homophobia in this book. Not that I would never write a young adult book with homophobia, but just in this particular story, I felt that there were so many other things going on. I didn't want that to be part of it. I wanted there to be a romance in the book that they could, that teen readers could enjoy despite all the other dark things that are happening, and have it not be like tainted by homophobia and those types of things. So I took a lot more care, I think, with the reader experience on this book. With my adult books, I tend to just like go heavy. I'm like, look, these are going to be dark, you know, like trigger warning for everything. Even though sexual assault is something I tend to not do ever anyway. But just in general, apart from that, I tend to be more, I guess, a little bit, you know, you're an adult reading it. I think that I'm a little bit less, I guess, careful. Whereas with teenage readers, I wanted to make sure to really think every single thing through and like make sure that I was being careful with my readers in a new way. And I also really wanted to unpack the emotions of the characters. In my adult thrillers, I do that. But I noticed in this one, I was really trying to make sure that like the motivations were clear and we understood why she's doing this. And the romance between them is really, the emotions they're feeling in the romance is really clear. Because it's young adult, you know, the emotions are more front and center.
It's refreshing to hear another novel being written that doesn't include homophobia, because coming out to me is so... It's an important thing to write about. It's difficult for so many of us. But I don't want to read it necessarily in every book.
That's right.
I know there's still plenty of homophobia that exists, but my daughter's 23, and she and her friends in high school, it wasn't even – and she lived in Omaha. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even anything they thought about. It's just the way people were, which I'm really happy to see. So I'm glad you went that direction with it. Why thrillers? What is it about the dark, gritty, chilling? I know you've written about mental illness.
Yeah.
What is it that attracts you to that?
I did not write thrillers on purpose. I would sit down to try to write something more literary, and mystery thrillers is what would come out. I think sometimes, I don't know, it's like a suit that fits us or something. Like, it just, it, and it's funny because I've always loved mystery. Mystery has always been my favorite. And when I look back on myself as a young person and look back on my early teenage self, quoting Edgar Allan Poe and like all the ridiculousness, I'm like, of course I would write mysteries and thrillers, but I don't know. I first of all, I think I'm attracted to the puzzle of mystery. I think even my favorite books that are not technically mysteries are mysteries. Like, I love a book where, for example, Fried Green Tomatoes, that book is a mystery thriller. You know what I mean? Like, the if you look at the actual plot, I just like crime fiction, I think. Even in genres that you wouldn't think are necessarily crime fiction, I like that type of plot where you're trying to figure it out and what's going to happen next. I don't know. I like suspense. I like the way it feels to read that. And then I like the way it feels to go back and reread it, now knowing, and that satisfaction of like seeing all the little things now that you know the answer. So I don't know. I mean, I actually have written a dystopian book. I really enjoyed writing dystopian. I've written contemporary. I've tried to write literary. So I'm not saying that would be the only genre I'd ever write, but I can see why I end up writing these, because I do find them so satisfying.
Yeah, I don't know why I haven't read any of Fanny Flagg's other novels, because I loved Fried Green Tomatoes.
Same here. I don't know why I haven't either. I loved that book. Oh, my God.
I would say the movie captured it as well as a two-hour movie can.
Me too.
But obviously, it's never the same. But I think they did. I think they gave it justice for as far
they
as
they had good casting.
Yes, totally. They did. It was excellent. Mm-hmm. It was excellent. Your writing process. I looked at some of your articles. I don't know if they were in Crime Reads, or I know you've written for Writer's Digest as well. What is your writing process as far as getting started?
Yeah, so I have kind of gone back and forth on how much I want to outline. I know some people do scene by scene. Like, I was just talking to Tori Eldridge. She wrote The Ninja Daughter and the Li Wong series. And yesterday we were on a hike together, and she was telling me that she outlined scene by scene, like every single scene she has planned before she starts writing her book. And I can't do that. Like, I feel like I don't know the characters well enough. I can't picture it clearly enough to outline it scene by scene. But if I don't outline enough, I find myself kind of panicking and feeling like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to write. I don't know what happens next. So I've sort of struck a medium with myself where I go in knowing the major plot points, like the beat sheet, you know, the beginning, the break into two, the midpoint. I kind of know what's going to happen in the fun and games. I write in four acts, like, so I really kind of think of the first half of, and the second half of act two as two totally separate acts. And then I usually know where the dark night of the soul beat is going to hit, like about what kind of thing that's going to be. And I usually don't know the ending. And that's where I'll go in starting. And then I'll say, okay, and I'll actually like beat out act one. And I'll write like my list of things I think that my scene list of what I think the scenes will look like in act one. I'll go through and I'll write them, and then I'll stop. And then I'll do the same thing for act 2A. I'll kind of, now that I'm here, what does it look like? You know, I'm sure my plans might have to change. So I kind of do it one quarter of the book at a time, and that helps me not feel so overwhelmed. And then it also helps me not like plan a bunch of stuff that ends up changing. That always seems to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't usually get a lot into the writing process, because you get asked that so often on different podcasts and radio. The reason I brought up with you is you just said the word beat sheets. Mm-hmm. And when I read that article and was reading some of the things you said, I said, she's familiar with Save the Cat.
Yeah.
So then I don't know. I was curious. I dug it up somewhere where you did mention Save the Cat. For those that don't know what that is, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's really a screenwriting method of outlining where, and there's a lot of other plot organizational tools that talk about beats as well. Like, I think Anatomy of Story breaks it down to 15 beats or something, or 44 beats. I can't remember how many. And there's another one that's like the 15 story beats. Like, the word beat has sort of evolved from Save the Cat, but I believe Save the Cat is where it began. And that's where you hear the term beat sheet came from, Save the Cat. And it's really about, first of all, working within a three-act structure, but then he outlines very specific key points in the story and what those key points need to be. Like, for example, he says, a book should begin with an opening image that gives you this type of idea. And in this part of the story, book, screenplay, whatever, there should be the theme stated. Like, he's very specific. He says someone outside of the character needs to state the theme, like, you'll never find a man this way, or whatever the book is about, the movie's about. And then the character would reply with something that tells you where they're at, and that's what needs to change. Or like, there's one thing that he says about the beginning of a story that hits me every time. He says, this is a broken world and only the hero can fix it. This is a broken world and only the hero can fix it. And I swear to God, that helps me every single time make sure that when I'm going into act one, I'm showing why this world is broken and why my hero is the right person or the only person to really fix it. So like in She's Too Pretty to Burn, you open with like the main character and her mom having this problem that tells you this is what's wrong. This main character's world is broken. And you can see that she needs to somehow escape from it, but she doesn't know how. It's like that really helps me start a story. So I find Jessica Brody is the author of Save the Cat, writes a novel. I really recommend both of those. I cannot recommend them enough. They're very helpful.
Yeah, I love Save the Cat, Writes a Novel. I've read both books, and Save the Cat, Writes a Novel is kind of how I start. I don't go in depth in every scene, but I do have every scene mapped out.
Yeah.
Now, when I'm done, like you said, you have to change the format. So I'm constantly going back and changing my outline. So in the end, it may not look anything like what I had in the beginning, but I do need that Save the Cat outline format just to even get started. It's really difficult for me otherwise. Doing it in parts like you do is kind of an interesting idea. You said you don't know the endings. Is that a general rule that you have no idea?
I never know the ending. Yeah, I always surprise myself with, and it's funny, the ending is the only part of the book that I often will like kind of wing it. Like I'll force myself to not know. Like for example, with the Kill Club, the ending of that book is kind of wild. And I only let myself plot to the Dark Night of the Soul where the character is like trapped. There is no way to get out. I write her into like such a corner that it is like, I don't know what to say. You're so screwed. And I remember calling my agent and being like, okay, I have a problem. My deadline is in like 5 weeks and I do not know how to get her out of here. Like I've done it. Like I did the best job of writing her into a corner, but I seriously don't know how to get her out. And I actually had like to have my agent help me like discuss some ways that act three could go down. So yeah, I will purpose, but I think personally, I like want a thriller to feel like there is no way out. And I only feel like I can achieve that authentically if I, as the author, am kind of panicking. There's no way out of here. And so in Pretty to Burn, I literally wrote the character into a place where there is physically no way out. And I had to go, I'm never going to forget, I was sitting in a bar, panicking at a hotel bar with like five friends on DM, being like, I got to get her out of this beep. I don't want to say, but this is,
oh, you can
place.
Say.
Well, I just want to say because I don't want to spoil it.
Oh, like, okay. I thought you were trying to hold back a cuss word. Okay.
No, I was like physically, like I was like actually researching like the specs of this place that I had put her in. Like, no, but it was like, you know what I mean? Like I did not have a plan. So I don't know what's wrong with me. It makes me feel more invested if I don't know. It makes me feel like I'm panicking. So hopefully the reader is also panicking.
Yeah, I have half written, probably a little more than half written a thriller. I set it aside for a while, but I had no idea what I was writing. And there was a scene that I was writing where I was practically hyperventilating. My hands were getting sweaty.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, oh, this is good. This is a good sign.
Yeah.
So someday I'll get back to that. But so far it's been mysteries for me. And can you get a little more into what the thrill factor is with She's Too Pretty to Burn, or would that give too much away?
No, it's fine. So it's a little bit like, so the main character and the two main characters, there's two point of views. They get into a quick, like whirlwind romance where Veronica meets Mick at a party, and Veronica has a best friend named Nico. And so Nico is the like Sir Henry Dorian Gray character. And Veronica and Nico are like besties. They're artists together. Nico is an installation artist. And so he does what he calls disruptive installation art, where he, it's somewhere between pranks and installations, where he does these massive, almost like sabotages, and he's sort of interested in using art as a political statement or as a way to disrupt. He's targeting this congressman who's been really doing all these terrible environmental policies. They're in San Diego. And so he's following this congressman all over San Diego and doing these disruptive installation pieces at the congressman's events, at his house, at his, you know, fundraisers, and his installations are getting like increasingly more dangerous. And Veronica is used to Nico. She's always done the photography for his installations. She's a photographer, and so she'll photograph them and they'll put them online on his like anonymous Tumblr site. But Mick gets wrapped into this, and Nico takes a real interest in Mick and starts kind of involving her in this, in this installation art gets off the rails. So it's like a very dangerous, and those art pieces were like the most fun things to write. Honestly, like that I've ever written, having to plan these like massive art heists all over San Diego. It was pretty awesome.
Well, I guess
that, terrifying.
I guess that probably comes from your background in visual.
Yeah, it was like fantasy, like dark art fantasy, you know, like what's the most dangerous thing you could do with art?
I was reading one of your articles in Crime Reads. Mm-hmm. And there was something that jumped out at me, and actually was bolded anyway. You wrote, if female-centric stories are squeezed out of a literary space, we make them happen inside genre fiction. Could mm-hmm. you elaborate what you meant by that?
Well, and like I know it's not very nice of me, is it? It's not very likable of me to talk like this. But, you know, so if I'm a man, particularly a straight man, and I'm going to write a really important story about the fabric of our society. So I'm going to write about marriage and about my experience in marriage, right? And like this crumbling marriage between a man and a woman, and really get into his psychology and the pain he's experiencing and unpack that through a literary perspective. And you make social commentary, and there will be romantic scenes between him and his wife, and like the sex scenes will be really fraught, and this will be an important literary book that's talking about the place of romance in the middle-aged experience and what it is to be a Gen Xer, blah, 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 blah. If I'm a woman writing this book, it's a romance novel. This is a romance novel. Or this is like a domestic, this is a woman's fiction, right? Women's fiction. This is not a literary book that I am describing if written through the point of view and the authorship of a woman most of the time. And so that was me being a little snarky about that. You know, it's like if we feel alienated from the ability to make important social commentary and these types of things in literary fiction, and that our domestic experiences are kind of small and maybe not as important as, you know, it's like the difference between an arts and crafts museum and an arts museum, right? Like what's in an arts and craft museum? There's art in there that women make, you know, for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. And in the art museum is the fine art. And so I think people do a good job of, they want to tell their stories. And so if those stories about marriage and the danger of marriage for women are not happening in a literary space, then women turn them into thrillers and make them happen in domestic thriller space. And that's like a huge market now, right? Because those stories are really important for women, and marriage can be dangerous for women. And so that's kind of what I meant by that.
Well, and you brought up something I was thinking about. You know, over the years, it's become more and more prevalent to have women writing mystery novels. I think there were a lot more women that wrote mystery novels than people realized, but it was mostly a male genre.
You're right.
It's the number of women writing thrillers, to me, has exploded.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is? Is it based on what you were saying earlier? That
I think that women know fear. And we know how to write about fear, because fear is something that women are marinated in a lot of ways. And so it's like, if you want someone to write about fear and what it feels like to be afraid and to make a piece of art that will make the reader afraid, someone who's, you know, who cannot go running in the dark, someone who lives an entire life with like one eye over each shoulder, you know, can only put one headphone in at a time, can't take public transport after dark, you know, it lives in fear of, and they know what could happen to them. And often those things have happened to them. You know, I think something like, I don't know, more than half of women by the time they leave college have been sexually assaulted in one capacity or another. So it's one of those things where it's like women know fear, and women find, this is interesting. I had a psychiatrist tell me this. She told me that for people who are feeling fear or anxiety, reading something scary or watching something scary can be very therapeutic because it completes a stress cycle. So it resolves at the end. So if you're having a panic attack and you watch something scary, at the end of that scary movie, you will physiologically experience relief from having finished that stress cycle with the story. Whereas on your own, you will just spin and spin and spin and spin. I find that kind of fascinating that women are attracted to stories about fear. Maybe it helps kind of process the fear that we're just so used to feeling that we just don't even feel it anymore. You know, like I was walking with my daughter and there was like a white van. We were walking on the sidewalk. I was like, oh, we've got to cross the street and walk to the other side. We can't walk by that van. It just doesn't look right to me. It was kind of one of those ones where the windows were all blocked. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, we're not walking by that van. I have to teach her. Don't walk. Okay, this is a teaching moment. If you ever see a van like that parked in front of a park or something, don't walk by it. Someone could be underneath it. Someone could come out of the back doors. You just got to stay far away from a van like that. Like, these are the types of things we have to kind of always be very aware of. Don't walk too close to the van doors. Better not to walk too close to car doors in general. Stay on the other side of the sidewalk, away from the street. So I think to myself, yeah, maybe this is helping women process, you know, helping us process.
Well said. I think more men need to be aware of the process or be respectful for women in that way. For example, if I'm walking at night and there's a woman approaching, I will purposely move away because I know possibly in her mind that, like, oh, here's a man coming at me. And to avoid that, I try to move aside to give a little space for their comfort level. I'd like to see more men go through that as well.
I've had a lot of moments with men on escalators where if I'm wearing a dress, I'll step to the side and be like, you first. And they're like, no, you first. I'm like, no, really, you first. And they're like, no, you first. And I'm like, for God's sake, I don't want you standing behind me on this escalator. You first. Like, it's just one of those funny things where you're like, just please, just go. I'm begging you. Please don't make me walk up these stairs while you can see up my dress. Like, I'm...
Yeah. Well, we are going to have to wrap up the show. But before I do, we have what's called Awkward Questions Authors Get.
Oh, yeah.
And I solicit dozens of authors for questions that they've been asked that are either hard to answer or just bizarre.
Okay.
So I'm going to spin the wheel and see what you get. So hold on while I spin the wheel. Okay, you ready for your question?
I'm ready.
All right. Your question is, as opposed to crime genre, are you ever going to write a real book?
Oh, God. You know what? I want to tell you something. I have a secret now, apparently not secret anymore, dream. I'm going to, under a pen name, write an important literary book and see if I can get it published under a pen name just for fun, just to see if I can. I want to know if I can do it, or I want to know if I am capable. I want to describe things a lot. I think in my book, there's going to be like a guy, he lives in the desert and like he doesn't see people, but he makes friends with a bird. That's my initial concept. And then through the friendship with the bird, maybe it's a crow and the crow like brings him stuff. And then one day the crow brings him something and he like has to try to find who the owner of it is. And he goes on a long soul searching journey. That's my literary fiction idea. And someday that'll be a real book. My other books aren't real books though. So yeah, it's not important.
Well, I think entertainment. I think entertainment is important. I've had quite a few reviews, good reviews that said it's a good beach read. And I like that because that just means they enjoyed chilling out and reading the book. But you just gave away a good idea for a literary novel. Shame on you.
Dang it. Copyright infringement. Trademark. TM.
Exactly. Okay, so once again, your podcast is on likable female characters, and I would recommend anybody listen to the show. It's actually very funny, and it's out every other week? Okay. And my guest is Wendy Hurd, and her most recent novel that is currently on pre-order is She's Too Pretty to Burn. I almost said She's Too Heavy to Burn. She's Too Pretty to Burn.
That too. Don't burn her for so many reasons.
Yeah, just don't burn her
for a lot of reasons.
Well, Wendy, it's been great having you on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.